I'd like to begin the sermon today with a story. We'll give credit where credit is due. It's written by Pierre Will and is found on the website niceinspirationblogspot.com. Did my very best to contact him over a course of time for permission to read his story. Haven't heard back, so I'm going to read it and assume that if I give him proper credit, he will understand that certainly we appreciate very much his insight here. And if not, we'll do the best we can to make amends. It's called A Stonecutter's Story. There once was a stonecutter who was dissatisfied with himself and his position in life. One day he passed a wealthy merchant's house. Through the open gateway, he saw many fine possessions and important visitors. How powerful that merchant must be, thought the stonecutter. He became very envious and wished that he could be like the merchant. To his great surprise, he suddenly became a merchant, enjoying more luxuries and power than he had ever imagined. But he was also envied and detested by those less wealthy than himself. Soon, a high official passed by, carried in a chair, accompanied by attendants and escorted by soldiers beating gongs. Everyone, no matter how wealthy, had to bow low before the procession. How powerful that official is, he thought. I wish I could be a high official. Then he became a high official, carried everywhere in his embroidered chair, feared and hated by the people all around. It was a hot summer day, so the official felt very uncomfortable in the sticky sedan chair. He looked up at the sun. It shone proudly in the sky, unaffected by his presence. How powerful the sun is, he thought. I wish I could be the sun. Then he became the sun, shining fiercely down on everyone, scorching the fields, cursed by farmers and laborers. But a huge black cloud moved in between him and the earth, so that his light could no longer shine on everything below. How powerful that storm cloud is, he thought. I wish I could be a cloud. And then he became a cloud, flooding the fields and villages, shouted at by everyone, but soon he found that he was being pushed away by some greater force and realized that it was the wind. How powerful the wind is, he thought. I wish I could be the wind. And sure enough, he became the wind and began blowing tiles off the roofs of houses, uprooting trees. He was feared and hated by all below him. But after a while, he ran up against something that would not move no matter how much force he blew against it, a huge, towering rock. How powerful that rock is, he thought. I wish I could be a rock. And sure enough, he became the rock, more powerful than anything else on earth. But as he stood there, he heard the sound of a hammer pounding a chisel into the hard surface, and he felt himself being changed. What could be more powerful than I, the rock, he thought. He looked down and saw far below him the figure of a stonecutter. The moral of the story is, be content with what you have. Are you content? Would you describe yourself as a contented person? I'd like to address this topic of contentment in our Christian walk. Certainly today, during this time of year, materialism is pushed at us from every direction. And even though we don't keep this holiday, you just sense the materialism awash in the culture. We can, if we are not careful, see as a Christian that we may not be content. If I see I am not content, am I in danger of spiritually drowning and being destroyed? It's possible. It's a serious matter for us. Let's define contentment to begin with. So we all are talking about the same thing. The American College Dictionary defines contentment as, quote, having desires limited to what one has, satisfied. And then it adds this, easy in mind. I think if you think of a contented person, you think of someone who's relaxed, accepting things the way they are. Webster's dictionary adds this. They define contentment as to appease the desires of. And then it says this, to limit oneself in requirements, desires, or actions. We begin to see that contentment has an aspect of limiting the self. If you look up the word contented, it says this, feeling or manifesting satisfaction with one's possessions, status, or situation. See, unlike the stonecutter who was not content where he was, always wanted to be somewhere else, the proverbial grass being greener on the other side of the fence, simply was not true. He could not manifest satisfaction with his possessions or status or situation. Now, the etymology of the word content in English comes from the French, which comes from the Latin contentus, from past participle continere, to hold in. We talked earlier about how contentment has an aspect of limiting oneself. The word literally comes from the word to hold in, to restrain. And when we think about contentment and where we'll go in the scripture with it, we'll see this issue of having to hold in self-control, we might say, being a portion of this. The Greek word, often translated content, means to be satisfied, adequate, needing no assistance, hence content. Today we'll ask a series of questions of ourselves to see if we can determine our level of contentment. We'll ask, first of all, do I covet material possessions? Do I covet material possessions? Turn with me to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. You know where we're going. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. One of God's great commandments, one of the 10 cardinal points of God's law, has to do, in essence, with contentment. We might state this in a slightly different way. Could we state this commandment? Be content with what you have. Is it possible to state it that way? Let's take a look. Exodus 20 and verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. Now, if we pause there for a second, isn't it interesting that God gives this law really in advance? Because where were the Israelites when this command was spoken to them? They're in the wilderness. Not one of them had a house. They all had tents. They were just about to begin this 40 years of wandering, and not one of them had a house. But God, looking forward, realizing these commandments need to be for all people for all time, don't covet your neighbor's house. Now, I wonder about the order. I think we could certainly truncate this commandment simply saying, you shall not covet. That's the commandment. The rest of the list are simply examples of things that people tend to covet. Interestingly, house is listed first. I recently was at a person, I don't think you could know them, but at a person's house, probably a 3,500 square foot home, and they were lamenting about how their friends had recently moved into a 4,500 square foot house, and how theirs, with their four people, in that 3,500 square foot house wasn't really, really enough room for them. Like, what do? The Irish jig around the house all day? I mean, how can 3,500 square feet not be enough room for you? Anyway, There's always that more. Your neighbor's house. It's got nicer things. It's a better location. It's got a better view. It has less traffic. It has more traffic. It's easier to get to. It's harder to get to. Whatever it might be. It's this issue of what's going on inside, this contentment. Then it goes on to say, the second thing, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. And of course, if you're a woman, this would be your neighbor's husband or the potential of your neighbor's husband. In other words, your spouse. Do not covet your neighbor's spouse. It is possible to do that many times because we don't really know them. There was a marriage counselor I was listening to a number of years ago in trying to help God's people. Listen to this woman. She was quite an insightful counselor, and she counseled women about their marriages. And so she was talking about women and marriage, and she's talking to this group of ladies, and she said, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take your sheet of paper that's in front of you, take that pencil, and I want you to write down 10 things that irritate you about your spouse. Things that he's done that irritate you, character traits he has, habits that he has. Now she said, stop writing at 10. I know some of you might put on 30 or 40, but stop at 10. Some of you may have some trouble getting up to 10, but I want 10 things on that list. And so the ladies diligently wrote, and she said, I'd like to collect those now. So she collected them all, stood in front of the ladies and shuffled them all together, shuffled them all, and then handed them out one by one to each of the ladies. And she said, does it make sense to covet your neighbor's husband? Because you've just exchanged his 10 problems for the other guy's 10 problems. Do you get my point? And I thought that was pretty insightful. If you can't be content with what you have, then obviously we've got a serious problem. Do not covet your neighbor's wife. You really don't know them, and you really don't know what you're getting into. You have a photograph or a picture, a snapshot in your mind, but you really don't know what it's like to live with that person. Do not covet your neighbor's house, nor his wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything, and that's the point, anything that is your neighbor's. Now, if you're like me, sometimes you think about this and you say, well, what's the line between wanting nicer things, working for nicer things, a nicer car, a nicer home, nicer clothing, nicer stuff, whatever it might be. For some, it's going to be those things that we work with our tools in the garage. Well, I could use a better tool than this. I could use a, 10 amp or 18 amp, cordless drill. That would be the cat's meow. Other person says, I don't even care. I will never use a drill, period. I'll call somebody, come drill what I need drilled. Right? Point is, it's always something that's on the list. And if it is our neighbors, then that's really a problem. Because now we're talking about destroying our neighbor. We want what he or she has. And that leads to real trouble. Now the word covet here, you shall not covet. The fourth word in the verse is the Hebrew word chamad, and it means to delight in. If we read that definition, you shall not delight in your neighbor's house and take delight in his. Well, what does that mean? I'm supposed to be taking delight in my house, in my wife, in my husband, in my servants, if we have them, etc., etc. It means beauty. It means greatly beloved. It means to covet. So what we see is that the eyes have a role to play here. We delight in, we desire, we lust after a pleasant thing. So where is that line between desiring to improve or to have nicer things and coveting? And for you, I cannot give that answer. I have trouble defining it for me. But that's something each of us before God has to sort through. Is this a right desire? Is this a good desire? Or is it a coveting that I've got to have this? If that's the case, we'll find that it's probably never enough. Now turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy 5, as you well might remember, is the second stating of the Ten Commandments. God gave them in Exodus 20. Moses restates them, we might say, here in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And one interesting thing is that the wording is not exactly the same in the second giving of the commandments. Now, Moses is not rewriting them. But you wonder if, as he dealt with Israel, at this point, Israel's the second generation. They're about to go into the promised land, and he's educating them on what God expects of them. So when it comes to the commandment about coveting in verse 21, it's slightly different, interestingly enough. Now, again, the biblical principle of addition applies here. You don't take one and say that's correct and the other incorrect. You add them together to get the full meaning. So in this case, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. The word covet here is a different word. It's the word ahwa, and it means to wish for, to greatly desire, to covet, to be desirous, to long for, to lust after. Same principle, but different word. So again, sometimes critics of the Bible say, well, see, Moses just rewrote them here. Well, obviously not. He used a synonym for coveting, depending or compared to Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. So you shall not covet, to set your heart upon, we might say. We'll look at that in the New Testament. You're not to wish for, covet, your neighbor's wife. Remember what it said back in Exodus chapter 20? What was the first thing on the list there? It was your neighbor's house. Now, he puts the neighbor's wife first. Now, if you were to bring this into the 21st century, which would you put first on the list? Are men more likely to covet someone's house or their wife? Now, I'm just guessing. But I would say in today's hypersexualized society, my guess is that it would be the wife or woman, period. But in this case, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Do not desire, be desirous of, long for, lust after your neighbor's wife. And you shall not desire your neighbor's house. So house is second in this listing. And then it says his field. That wasn't even in the Exodus 20 list. Why would it be in this list? Well, they're just about to go into the promised land. What were they given when they went into the promised land? They were given land, given fields. So you divide up this area of Canaan into the 12 tribes, or between the 12 tribes and some on the other side of the Jordan as well, 2.5 tribes over there. You divide up this land amongst the tribes. Then the elders, I mean, God doesn't say, here's who gets this piece of property, here's who gets this piece of property. Who decided these things? Well, we assume that it may have been the elders of each of the tribes that actually portioned out the individual tracts of lands to the families. So Moses is setting this up in advance. You may get a tract of land. You may not think it's as good as, or as nice as, or as productive as, or as wooded as the next person's. Do not covet your neighbor's field, his land, his property. So again, the principle, you shall not covet, applies for all ages. I doubt that you've probably had a problem coveting your neighbor's male servant or his female servant, because I would guess your neighbor does not have a male servant or a female servant, unless you live in a place a lot different than the place I live in. Now, I might covet my neighbor's landscaper when I'm out on a hot day mowing the land and he's got somebody he's hired to do it. That's possible, but not likely. So the principle of not coveting applies for all time. The individual things listed that people tend to covet after might be different. Now, I didn't say here, don't covet your neighbor's Corvette or his Ferrari or his minivan. Okay, nobody covets a minivan. I'm just kidding. No. Some do. You got several children, you may covet a minivan. My point is the list changes based on the situation and on the culture. But the principle is always the same, to earnestly long after, to desire, to want to be desirous of what is your neighbor's is always going to be a problem. Now you get to the New Testament, and the Greek word for covet that's normally used is epithumeo, and it means to set the heart upon. It can be in a good way, to long for, When I'm away from my wife for an extended period of time, I covet her. I long to be back together with her. It's a right use of the word, a right use of the concept. But it also means to covet or desire in a wrong way, to lust after. So we see in the New Testament, let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, do I covet material possessions? I just want more stuff. I'm desiring these things. And again, the line between wanting to improve, wanting to have nicer things, and coveting is sometimes difficult to discern. So each of us on our knees before God has to sort through some of those things. And only you will know in your heart whether or not it's truly been coveting or not. There have been some situations that I know that I've coveted. After you get something, then you realize, you know, I didn't really need that. I don't really use it. It's not that big a deal. It's just another thing. And you realize, you know, I probably didn't have the right attitude and approach toward that at all. 1 Timothy chapter 6, in verse 6. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. I've wrestled with that verse for a long time, trying to understand exactly what God has intended with that. As Paul writes to Timothy, what is he actually getting at? Now, we know the background of the Pharisees and how Christ said, or John, the other apostles, as they wrote in the Gospels, that the Pharisees were lovers of money. They had a problem with that. So is Paul addressing that concept with Timothy as a younger minister, that godliness and contentment need to go together? The New American Standard translates the verse this way, but godliness actually is a means of great gain. He's talking spiritually. When accompanied by contentment. I think godliness is the gain. Contentment is one way we arrive there. Then it goes on in verse 7 to say, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. Isn't that true? Puts me in mind of the old story of the individual, very wealthy individual, who dies and goes to heaven. You know, the old Protestant thought of dying and going to heaven. And he gets to heaven, and Peter stops and says, by the way, we didn't tell you this beforehand, but there is one thing that if you want one thing, you can bring it up here from earth. Just one thing, though. So the fellow goes down and realizes that's wonderful. So he packs up every gold bar that he has. He says, I'm going to take this up to heaven. I'll be the richest man in heaven. He gets up to the gate and he gets ready to go in. And Peter says, let me inspect what you have. And he opens up, all these gold bars are shining. And he said, you brought street pavers? You know, the streets of gold, meaningless up there. But the coveting, I've got to have this. And that's what we see here. We brought nothing into the world. We're not going to take anything out. So what is the big deal about the stuff? Can we have a balance between enjoying the physical blessings that God gives us, but not pursuing them to the point of coveting? Verse 8, having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Wow, isn't that amazing to even think about? For middle-class Americans to think that we could be content if we have food and something to wear. Some of us may have stood this afternoon before coming to church in front of our closet saying, I have nothing to wear, in front of a closet of 30 different outfits, or 20 or 10, or whatever it might be. Some of our brethren in different places of the world do have the clothing they wear, and that's what they have. And yet they seem to be able to be content, and they somehow work out food. Even if it's a bowl of corn mush every day, that's contentment. It's amazing. Pam's been working with the grandchildren to tell you a quick story about this. you know those little bitty peanut butter cups, Reese's peanut butter cups? You wrap them up, and they're wrapped up in foil, and they come in a bag. Well, for me, you know, it says, you look on the back, it says one helping. For me, one helping is the bag. But she was working with the grandchildren, giving each of them one little peanut butter cup. And she said, you know what, don't want you to just eat this and just gobble it down because then it'll be gone. But I want you to savor it. You know what savor means? Well, no, of course not. They're five and two. A savor means just taste a little bit and roll it around in your mouth and enjoy each bite. And so it's just hilarious not to watch the children when they get their little treat. Oh, and to see their little face roll around. And so they're learning what it means to savor. And when we look at this, do we savor what we have? Or are we looking for the next thing? The next best thing? The next greater thing? Do we savor the home that we have? I always think of that scene in the movie with Jimmy Stewart where he's at his house, he's discontented with kind of his life and what's going on, and he goes to go up the stairs, and he puts his hand on that wooden ball that's on the top of the post, and it comes off, and he's ready to throw it through the window, and he sticks it back on there. And later, when his life changes and turns around, and he appreciates all these wonderful things he has, he goes running up the stairs, and he grabs it and pulls off, and he kisses it and puts it back on. Like, what? I have a home. I have a stairway. I have children upstairs who love me. Talk about a different perspective along the way. Verse 9 tells us, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare. The desire to be rich. Do I covet material things? Am I working my tail off to get stuff for the sake of getting the stuff? They fall into temptation and a snare. They run this rat race, this hamster cage over and over again to get the things, and they can't enjoy them when they have them. They fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. Verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many arrows. So it can be very difficult for us to understand the balance sometimes between the desire to have quality things, to have nice things, to improve our situation, to live a good life versus lusting or coveting that leads us into harm's way. I'd like to quote from the Swami Sivananda. I don't know who the guy is. I just looked up the quote, so I can't vouch for him. But I thought his quote was very helpful. He wrote, there is no end of craving. Isn't that true? There's no end of craving. Hence, contentment alone is the best way to happiness. Therefore, acquire contentment. Being happy with what we have. So we go to the second question. Do I covet more money? Do I covet material possessions is one aspect. Do I covet money or more money? This definition of coveting we'll look at in Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. Many times in the New Testament, coveting and covetousness has to do literally with silver. In ancient times, much trade was simply bartering goods for goods. Over the course of time, as the world shrank and got smaller and smaller, money kind of was invented along the way, coinage. First, it was silver, and of course, the weight is what mattered. Now, it was stamped into coins to identify a ruler or a nation or an empire. But over the course of time, money replaces, in many societies, the issue of goods for goods, or bartering, as we might call it. In the New Testament, literally, the word for coveting means a lover of silver. The Greek word, philaguros. A philaguros, against, philia, love of, and guros, silver, a love of silver. So if we're going to be coveting, we're probably a lover of silver. And that's what's stated here in Hebrews 13 in verse 5. Let your conduct be without a philaguros, without this love of silver, This love of money. Now, it's not talking about the metal or jewelry. It's talking about money. Let your conduct be without a philogouros. And be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. We'll look at that more in detail in a moment. When he says, do not let your conduct, the word conduct literally means your manner of life. Other translations render that, let your character. Let your manner of life be free from the love of money, is the way the New American Standard translates it. Let your character, your manner of life, be free from the love of money. That's not to say you don't use money properly or wisely or for good. Certainly can. Be content with what you have. How can we be content with what we have if it's less than someone else? If it's not as much as we'd like? If we'd like better things? Well, he says, remember this. He himself has said. It's an emphasis there. It's not just he said, but he himself, Christ himself said this. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I'll never desert you or forsake you. So that's how we can be content, because God has promised to always care for our needs, always provide for us what is essential, what we need to have, whether it's food, whether it's clothing, whether it's favor in our job, in our situations, in our neighborhoods. God can take care of those things. So we don't have to covet, because we have, quote unquote, the ace in the hole. We've got Jesus Christ on our side. So that, verse 6 then, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. The emphasis is not the Lord is my helper. The Lord is my helper. I don't have to covet after these things. I don't have to pursue these things till I die, till I give myself all kinds of health problems because I've been working so hard and so many hours I don't take care of myself. I've got a helper. The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? We've got the ultimate help in the universe. Thomas Fuller is quoted as having written, contentment consists not in adding more fuel, but in taking away some fire. That was an interesting way of looking at it. If I just add more fuel, I'm going to be happier. No, take away some of that fire. You don't need the fuel then to make the fire in that situation. So what are some signs that we may not be content and have fallen into the trap of coveting? Are there some signs? Well, I suppose we could identify a few. A huge amount of stuff around that we do not use. Ever have something you've purchased and then never used? There was a great sale at Mark's clearance section a couple of years ago. Okay, 15 years ago. And I thought it'd be a really good idea to have these under the cabinet lights. So here they were for $2.99, a package of three under the cabinet lights. This is going to be great. Put them in the garage, in the box, still in the bag. And last week, as I'm looking for other things, here are those stupid lights. So I said, you know, I stick them here in the garage, because it's not going to work in the kitchen for various reasons. Let me put them here in the garage so it'll illuminate my workbench. And I opened the instructions, and they are so absolutely complex, no wonder they were on sale at Mark's for $2, because nobody would use these stupid things. So what was that? That was coveting. Oh, it'd be a cool thing to have. Do we need under the cabinet lights? No, we got lights that light the kitchen. Do I need that? No. So you look at some of those things, what was I thinking? Huge amounts of stuff around that we do not use. That may be a sign that we fall into the trap of coveting. How about multiple numbers of the same item? Multiple variations of the same item. You know, I've got a cordless drill, but I think I need an 18-volt cordless drill with a light on it. Because that's what the new ones have. You don't just have the drill. You got a drill with a light on the end of it. And maybe it's a hammer drill. If I had that, I could like really screw screws in like a pro. How often do I screw screws in? Okay, maybe a couple times a week, maybe. Maybe. Do I need? No, I don't. Do we have multiple things, multiple numbers of the same item? Credit card debt brought on from spending beyond our means. Is that a sign of coveting, possibly, that we've fallen into that trap, that we cannot be content with what we have? How about jealousy when we see things that others have that we don't? Finding it very hard to celebrate their prosperity, their new thing, their new car, their new home, their new clothes. Would we find it hard to do that? Those might be a few things we would consider as robbing us of contentment. Turn with me to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Again, back a few pages. Went from Timothy to Hebrews, back to Timothy now. 2 Timothy this time, chapter 3. In preparing this sermon, I was surprised that this showed up in this list. I hadn't remembered this. I don't know how many times I've read this and even preached about this list, but did not remember that this was in the list. The list is a listing of why the end days, the last days, are going to be so dangerous and so perilous and so stressful. I mean, literally, some would translate this, know this, that in the last days, stressful times of stress will come. Dangerous is another way to translate that. Perilous is certainly a way. That in the last days, perilous, dangerous, stressful times will come. Why? Well, Paul lists the characteristics that will be prevalent in society that will bring danger and peril and stress. For first of all, men will be lovers of themselves, totally selfish, out for number one. That's going to cause danger and peril and stress. But notice number two, lovers of money. Lovers of money, philaguros. It's not a philaguros, it's people who love money. Putting money before everything else. That's going to make things dangerous. When we look at some of the horrible things that have happened in our culture over the years, would you say that being lovers of money, in other words, we might say greed, has led to certain things? How about some of the terrible things that have happened by way of pollution, disasters along the way? We could very easily, in our part of the country, talk about the Cuyahoga River. So what was the problem? Why are we this, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years later, why are we now still not able to eat the fish in that river? Because of coveting, because of not contentment, because of all the industrial waste that just poured into that river over decades that have polluted it so badly the soil underneath the river is still to this day terribly polluted. And cannot, I mean, they say you can, but they don't recommend it. Well, great. What is that? Well, because of the greed that was involved, the love of money over all other concerns. So the second thing in the list of end time problems that make the culture dangerous, perilous, stressful, is love of money. So we want to be sure that we are not stuck in that kind of coveting cycle, but that we can be contentment. Deborah Taylor Hugh wrote about contentment robbers that she wrote that stress her. The first thing that she put on her list was mail order catalogs, a source of robbing contentment. Mail order catalogs, beautiful items in those catalogs for her were a constant reminder of all the things she didn't have and could have on credit even. All she would have to do is fill out that little form and mail it in. Of course, you can tell she wrote her list a little while ago, because fewer and fewer are printing catalogs these days. In fact, you may have heard, just as a quick sidelight, IKEA, yes, IKEA, is going to, as of this year, stop publishing their catalog. Now, you might not be aware, but IKEA Catalog was the largest publication in the world. In the world. 37, I think, different languages this catalog was published in, sent all over the world, and they're going to stop. Why? Because of the internet. You can look it up online. It was also one of the biggest expenses in IKEA's budget, is printing that catalog. Interesting. Nonetheless, you see the catalog, and then you got to have those things. One of the things she had on her list, which again dates it a bit, was shopping malls. Shopping malls, likewise, have gone the way of the dinosaur. But have strip centers? Obviously not. When we go down to Texas, it's just stunning to me. You drive up I-75 north of Dallas, and I mean, stop after stop after stop are these glitzy centers of shopping. And they've got grocery stores, and they've got Best Buys, and they've got Staples, and they've got, I mean, you start listing Bed Bath & Beyond. Then you've got this whole mall outlet area where all the, what do they call those, specialty stores. We don't go to them. I don't remember the name. But you got all these factory outlet stores. Oh, a whole host of them, 100 stores there. I mean, shop after shop after shop. And what do? If we're not careful, we can turn ourselves into a coveting machine. Certainly, we would say today. One of the things she put on her list was women's magazines. Women's magazines show how perfect homes can be, how beautiful clothes can be, how pampering personal toiletries can be all over. You're just not a real person unless you have this anti-wrinkle cream. Does anyone really believe those things? I mean, if an anti-wrinkle cream really worked, I mean, come on, people. Do we really think those things work? Are there people around here with no wrinkles because they've used anti-wrinkle cream? Come on! Okay, that's my rant for today. It's stunning. Only $75 for this 1 ounce of anti-wrinkle cream. Boy, I would put that over my whole body. I'd look like a baby again. Are you serious? These things are a ploy. Oh, my. But it makes me laugh. Like, surely people don't believe that, but they do. They pay that kind of money for these things. It can erase your wrinkles in 5 days. Oh, what a lie. I mean, how can you live with yourself lying like that? Nonetheless, she said women's magazines cause her great deals of challenges. Today, we would certainly add internet advertising. And the trick with internet advertising today is it can be so personalized. They know what you like. They know what you surf. They know what you click on. Not they, as in some mysterious person out there, but the machine. The machine learns these things. You click on some hardware item. What does it feed you? More hardware items. You click on one of those. It takes the two things you've clicked on and then estimates what you would be interested in. And by the time you're on this internet for a couple years, they know you. The machine knows you. And your machine is cooperating with their machines to entrap us. They will provide you very personalized advertising. In fact, what you type in the search bar, and as you type something into that search bar, what is completed on your behalf is different for you than it is for me, because it personalizes it based on your history. So more than ever before, coveting can be generated on the side of our screen. So I recommend sometimes just clicking on and searching for absolutely ridiculous random things just to throw the machine off. So, you know, you're looking at tools. Type in there sometime teeter-totter and just let the machine figure that one out. And then the next time type in toenail fungus and just see what happens, you know, see what goes on. Mix up the machine a little bit. Give them a hard time. Point is, we can, if we're not careful, get wrapped up in a cycle of coveting, and contentment is absolutely lost. Socrates once said, "He who is not contented with what he has would not be contented with what he would like to have." So you see, it's an attitude, it's an approach. So we'll end with the question, am I thankful enough for what I have? Or am I truly thankful for what I have? Am I thankful enough for what I have? Turn to Philippians, if you would, chapter 4. Philippians 4, we'll read verses 11 through 13. Now the Philippians were a wonderful congregation. They served and helped Paul and sent money to him so that he could continue on with the work that God had called him to do. But then there was a time that they let up and they neglected their responsibility and their duty in this regard. And then Paul realized they got back on track. And so at this point, he's thanking them. Verse 10, for example, says, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again." Now, why it stopped in the meantime? Did someone lie about Paul? Did someone step in and take those finances? And did they badmouth? We're not told what necessarily has happened. But there was this lag, and now it's back again. He says, "Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity." You just didn't follow through on that. So verse 11, "Not that I speak in regard to need." It's not that I'm starving to death. "For I have learned," he says, "in whatever state I am, to be content." To be content. What a great statement about the Apostle Paul. New American Standard says, "I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am in." In whatever circumstances. You mean to tell me I'm supposed to be content when I'm sick? When I've got a disease? I'm supposed to be content when I'm going through a job trial? When I don't have enough money to pay this month's bills? I'm supposed to be content? Paul says, "I've learned in whatever circumstances I'm in to be content." Now that goes back to what we read in the book of Hebrews. "Because I know Christ said he will never leave me or forsake me. So yes, I can be content. Whether it's illness, whether it's job trial, whether it's financial difficulties." He goes on to say in verse 12, "I know how to be abased." Other translations render that, "I know how to get along with humble means." I know how to get along with humble means. And he says, "I know how to abound." Others say, "I know how to live in prosperity." What would be difficult about living in prosperity? Well, the tendency to forget God, to not be appreciative of what we have, of the blessings we've been given, to look down on others who don't have as much, and maybe criticize them for where they are, why they may be there. He says, "I know how to be abased and how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need." He's saying, "I realize that there are spiritual lessons in being full. There's spiritual lessons in going hungry. There are spiritual lessons of having abundance, and there are spiritual lessons to learn in suffering great need." Again, the focus is a spiritual focus, not a physical focus. Then he says how that's possible in verse 13. "I can do all things." And he's referring specifically to those things he just talked about. "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." Through Christ who strengthens me is the way it says in the New King James. So this requires being thankful for what we have rather than lusting for what we do not have. It's a contentment of understanding that God is working with us, working with our spiritual character, and the secret is to have a close relationship with Christ. That contentment is there. It changes our perspective. Gilbert Chesterton wrote this, "True contentment is a thing as active as agriculture. What does he mean by that? He continues by saying, it is the power of getting out of any situation all that there is in it. He likens it to tilling a piece of ground, that you work with this ground to get as much out of it as you can. And he says, contentment is like that. No matter what circumstance you're in, you strive to get everything out of it of spiritual benefit that is there. And he finishes by saying, it is arduous and it is rare. It's arduous and it's difficult. It's rare to say, what am I supposed to be learning? What can I learn? You know, sometimes we make the mistake of saying, what am I supposed to learn from this? As if, as soon as I learn this, then it's going to go away. That doesn't happen. That's not what God says. Never says that. As soon as you learn the lesson, then it goes away. He doesn't say that. So, tilling the ground, understanding that there's things for me to learn that I can benefit from spiritually in the middle of all this. Will it go away at some point? I certainly pray it will. I have a helper who promises that he'll take care of me, even when I'm sick, even when I'm going through difficult times. Sometimes we think that being a Christian means God's going to take away all those things that are problems, or hard, or difficult, or painful. And that's not what he says. So to be content with his judgment in those circumstances really is one of the Christian struggles. To understand that he knows what is best. You see, otherwise we start thinking, well, I must be thick-headed. If I would just learn what he wants me to learn, this would go away. Why can't I learn what he wants me to learn? We're looking at that incorrectly. We are to be learning all the way through. And sometimes that lesson goes through the trial. As the trial goes on, as that difficulty goes on. So yes, it's like agriculture. Get as much as we can out of that circumstance. And then if God chooses to relieve us of that pain or that trial or that struggle, that'd be wonderful. We would always continue to pray that. At the same time, we realize God is working with our character. And God, if this is what's best for me, and it obviously is, or you wouldn't have me in the middle of the situation, I'm willing to do that. And that's sometimes a real challenge. So contentment is often the realization of how much we already have, not the getting of what we want or what we think we might need. So contentment tends to expel lust and covetousness. It tends to expel unhappiness. Contentment does not stack up debt. Contentment leads us toward the kingdom of God through thankfulness to God. So I'd like to close with Luke chapter 12 in verse 27. Luke chapter 12 and verse 27. We'll read through verse 31. I'll read this to you in the New American Standard Translation. Please follow along in whatever translation you have there on your lap. But it gives an approach to this issue of contentment. Being happy with what we have, contented with what we have. Luke 12 and verse 27. Christ speaking here says, consider the lilies. Consider the lilies. Think about flowers. How they grow. Now, I think when he says lilies, I'm not sure exactly what variety of plant he's talking about. But we have a couple of lilies in our backyard. They were gifts from Pam's students many years ago. And these are, they're not tiger lilies, they're not day lilies, they're not calla lilies. These are what are sometimes called Easter lilies. And they are beautiful. But you have to ask, how long do they last? Probably about 2 weeks is about all that you actually have blooms on these lilies. And they're spectacular when they're blooming. They're such a bright white, this beautiful stem and pestle on the inside, beautiful orangish color. They're delightful. Consider the lilies. Think about those. how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. In other words, they're just not all wrapped up in the getting process of toiling and spinning. Now, there's nothing wrong with toil and spinning, but he says, think about this for a minute. Yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Solomon apparently had some pretty nice duds. Gold threads probably woven into a lot of his clothing. The gold crowns, the fancy clothes. How many outfits he must have had. Christ says, look, no matter how good Solomon looked, there's nothing, nothing compared to the beauty of that little flower. If God arrays the grass in the field, so clothes the grass, which today in the field is and tomorrow thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? It seems to me contentment and faith are very closely allied to each other. Is it possible to be truly content? I mean, truly content with what we have without faith, without really trusting God knows what is best for us, for our circumstances, for our situation. Verse 29 then says, and do not seek what you shall eat. Don't put your whole energies into what you eat, what you shall drink, what you shall wear. And do not keep worrying. In the New King James, it says, nor have an anxious mind. So it's not a matter of, can I improve my life over the course of time? Can I have nicer things? Can I afford nicer things? Can I enjoy things with my family? Well, no, it's not the issue. But if we're seeking after, if that's where our focus is, he says in verse 30, for all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, or seek after. They eagerly seek. That's their focus. Can we be content with what we have? He says, but your Father knows that you need these things. So what are you worrying about? Why are you so focused on these things? That's what he's asking us. But seek, as you know in verse 31, seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. They'll all be taken care of. So, brethren, one of the great challenges of Christianity is the keeping of that commandment against coveting. Learning to be content in whatever situation we might find ourselves. So, brethren, let's do our part. Let's continue to develop the character trait of contentment and be thankful for all that God has blessed us with.